There's no question, and the research on nonverbal behavior really clearly shows that men take up more physical space than women, not just because they're bigger, they expand more, they take longer strides. Men talk more than women. Despite the stereotype, men actually speak more than women do. So they're taking up more airtime, you know, space in that way.
That's Amy Cuddy, a body language expert who is best known for her 2012 TED Talk on power posing. Her video received over 47 million views, and it became the second most popular TED Talk in history. This is the Sheen of AIDS podcast, and I'm your host, Michelle King. On our show, we share the challenges and triumphs of women in areas like innovation, technology, and entrepreneurship. Guys, I'm really excited about today's episode. I've invited professor and researcher from Harvard, Amy Cuddy, to join us on the show. Amy's going to be sharing the link on her research between confidence, competence, and body language. She's also going to be giving us tips on how we can come across as more self-assured at work without being seen as arrogant. So Amy, welcome to She Innovates. It's really fantastic to have you here today.
Thanks for having me.
Look, I thought we could maybe get started by getting you to share, you know, a little bit about your background and, you know, all the research that you do.
Sure. So I'm a social psychologist. That means I study how people react to situational pressures, right? So how do people's emotions and thoughts and behaviors change in response to other people's presence, whether that's actual or imagined or implied. And I was very interested in sexism and racism, and I'd been studying prejudice for a long time. And that's really what my background research is in that area. One of the things that I became sort of frustrated with was that, you know, a lot of research was documenting the presence of the problem, right? It's very easy to show that there's a lot of sexism and racism and other forms of prejudice, right? We have lots of evidence of that, but it's very difficult to find interventions that reduce prejudice. Now, I think we've made more progress in the last 10 years than we had when I was starting to really feel frustrated about this, but it's tough. You know, people are biased and they're unconsciously biased. And then there are people who are very consciously biased and don't want to change. So it's really hard to find ways to reduce prejudice at both the sort of systemic organizational level and at the interpersonal level. So caring about groups that are already disempowered and marginalized and stigmatized, it was disheartening to be talking to people about these findings. You know, prejudice is rampant without having solutions. You know, if I talk to a group of, say, young women and told them, well, here are the data on, you know, what the workforce looks like and what kinds of biases you might expect to encounter, and not to be able to say, here's what you can do, it made me feel pretty bad about what I was doing. I think the work documenting prejudice is incredibly important, don't get me wrong, and I continue to do work in that area as well. But I wanted to be able to offer people tools, knowing that prejudice is not going to go away overnight. And I'm still sending people out to job interviews. How do I not give them a tool to help themselves prepare for, you know, a situation that is going to be challenging and often unfairly challenging? So that's sort of how I moved into this area of trying to understand what makes us feel powerful or powerless. And how does that affect our ability to really show up in difficult situations?
So, Amy, I mean, all your research sounds fascinating. I know you've also done some on the mind-body connection. So could you maybe share a little bit about that and how it can impact confidence?
The body-mind connection is really more about changing the way you carry yourself physically in a way that changes the way you feel and the way you think. So yoga, it kind of captures both of those things. And, you know, these are like very, very old traditions. It's not really a new idea, but we've always kind of focused on the mind-body direction as opposed to the body-mind direction. And what's nice about changing your posture or your movement in order to change the way you think and feel is that it's actually easier. Humans are not very good when they feel bad about themselves. So when we're feeling stressed out, when we're feeling bad about ourselves, we do not do a very good job of talking ourselves off the ledge. We don't trust ourselves in those moments. You know, if you just try to tell yourself, oh, actually, no, I'm great. You know, the idea of sort of self-talk, you know, imagine yourself winning and you'll win. That's great when you're feeling good about yourself. That helps you when you're feeling good about yourself. But when you're feeling bad about yourself and you're feeling stressed and you're feeling threatened by other people, I don't mean threatened like you really think they're going to attack you, but you are in a sort of state of threat, you're not going to be very good at just changing the way you feel or changing the way you think of yourself. We just know that this is true. People are not very good at this. In fact, you even get these rebound effects. So if you tell people, don't think this way, they're more likely to think that way. So it's really tough to do that. But what you can do is, you know, because the body and the mind are so, they're not even separable. It seems silly to even separate them. But, you know, because there's information exchange always going in both directions, and because feelings of power and powerlessness are so much reflected in how we carry ourselves, I started to think about whether you could change your body language in a way that would change the way you felt. And so then you're not having to talk yourself off the ledge. You're kind of walking yourself off the ledge.
I think that's amazing, you know, that you can actually have control over how you feel simply by changing sort of your body language. What about that in relation to feeling powerful? So, you know, how can we feel more powerful, and what happens at work when we do?
You know, so if you embody power by expanding, by stretching out and taking up space, which is exactly what all animals do, all species do this. When an individual has power, that individual stretches out, takes up more space, occupies maybe a higher point, you know, on the land, and humans do the same thing. So if you adopt those postures privately before you go into a challenging situation, not in front of people, because that's, whether you're male or female, taking up too much space in front of other people, it does not go well. But if you prepare by opening up rather than sort of making yourself small and going into the fetal position, you will feel more powerful. People feel more powerful when they adopt powerful body language. And when we feel more powerful, you get a whole constellation of psychological and behavioral changes. So what happens when people feel powerful, and by powerful, I mean power to, not power over. So power to do things as opposed to power over other people. So this is not zero-sum power. But when you feel powerful, it activates what we call the behavioral approach system, which means that people are more likely to see the world as a place that's not threatening, but that's filled with opportunities. So challenges become opportunities rather than threats. People become potential allies and collaborators, not predators. We're more likely to take action, stand up for ourselves and for other people. All of these things change when we feel powerful. When we feel powerless, it activates the inhibition system. We shut down. We don't think creatively. We become pessimistic. We don't act on behalf of ourselves or others. You get these completely opposite sets of outcomes. So changing your body changes your mindset. And we know that when you change your mindset, you change your behavior, and changing your behavior ultimately changes your outcomes.
So Amy, have you done any research that looks at some of the, you know, long-term effects of this? So particularly with sort of the mind-body piece and confidence, is there research to show that this actually helps or hinders you over the long term?
I don't do any longitudinal research in this area, which would look at, you know, change over time. As an experimental psychologist, usually in lab settings, we're not very good at doing that. We're not sort of set up to do that kind of work. But I'm glad that you say, you know, include reviewing the literature, because the nice thing is that there are lots of fields that are looking at longer term change, and there you do see these longer term effects, right? So a lot of the studies that look at long term effects look at things like yoga based interventions that are, you know, focused on particular kinds of postures or breathing, which is, I think, it's so simple. It's almost so simple that it's hard to believe that it can have such a big effect, but we know that changing our breathing changes the way we feel, and that that can be sustained over time because it's recursive, right? It's happening in both directions. So you change your breathing, you feel more confident, you feel more confident, you're breathing in a slower, deeper way, you know, again, reinforcing the confidence. So the more people practice these things, the easier they become and the more sustaining those changes are.
In 2016, the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology published a study on age and gender differences in self-esteem. Across 48 countries, the research showed significant gender gaps, with men consistently reporting higher self-esteem than women. So, Amy, you know, one of the areas that I'm particularly interested in is gender differences. So have you found any gender differences in your research in terms of men and women and their confidence or physical presence?
So there's no question, and the research on nonverbal behavior really clearly shows that men take up more physical space than women, not just because they're bigger, they expand more, they take longer strides. Men talk more than women. Despite the stereotype, men actually speak more than women do. So they're taking up more airtime, you know, space in that way. They speak more slowly than women. So in just about every way that you can imagine, men take up more space.
Right. But I mean, is it learned or is it innate? I mean, what's your view on that?
Now, when you look at little kids, you kind of get the answer just by observing children, because what you see is that little kids don't differ. Boys and girls are behaving very similarly. You know, girls are running around with their arms up in the air and doing cartwheels and screaming. And, you know, they're not worried about being dainty and small. But when they hit middle school, so around age 11, you start to really see changes in how they carry themselves, right? You start to see the girls making themselves small, like pulling their sleeves down over their hands and touching their hair and covering their necks. I mean, that's when they get worried about, you know, weight, right? They want to physically be smaller, just using this very meek-looking body language. And so we've done some studies with little kids to try to figure out if this is innate or if this is something they're learning. So is this a stereotype they're learning, or is it just something that kids are born sort of knowing, that somehow girls know that they should be different? Our research shows really clearly that kids are learning this, right? So this is a stereotype that they learn. So if you ask four-year-olds to look at a bunch of dolls, wooden dolls, like an artist doll, in expansive or contractive postures, so powerful or powerless postures, and you say, which one's the boy and which one is the girl, they definitely show a bias where they think the expansive, powerful-looking dolls are boys and the contractive, powerless-looking dolls are girls. And note that the dolls don't differ. It's the same doll. So it in no other way differs. By age six, though, that association becomes much stronger. They show a much, much stronger bias. So what that tells us is that they are learning the stereotype through exposure to things that confirm that stereotype. They're seeing more images of women and girls who are in sort of meek, powerless-looking postures, and more images of boys and men in open, expansive, powerful-looking postures. And by the time they hit middle school, they really start to express those stereotypes. So they've sort of learned them before middle school, but something about middle school, something about that age, activates those stereotypes as expressions of themselves.
So Amy, you know, I'm a parent. I've got two little kids, a daughter and a son. And one of the things, you know, I'm sure a lot of listeners who are parents are wondering is, you know, how can we apply some of this research to the next generation? So how can we raise our kids differently? You know, what are the things that we can do, given all your research findings on confidence and body language? What's your advice?
As you say, I have no daughters. I have only a son. I do not want my son to take up less space. That's not what I'm arguing for at all. And I want to be really clear about that. I want to see him feel proud and powerful and confident. I'd just like to see the girls feel that they can take up as much space as the boys, right? That we need to teach our daughters that they are allowed to take up their fair share of space in the world and, you know, to share their ideas and to unapologetically show their strength. Because right now, we're not there. Girls still feel that looking strong is risky. So we need to not only show them that there's no difference, girls and boys equally deserve to do this, but also we have to make it safe for them to do it. We have to encourage it. And so then we're not going to be dealing with questions when people are in their 40s about how to get women to speak up in the boardroom. You know, I feel like saying, don't ever tell them to stop speaking when they're little kids, because that's really what's happening. It's not that girls innately want to speak less and want to be smaller than boys, they're learning that that's the way they're supposed to be. They're learning that that's a societal prescription.
You know, you've made so many good points there about how important it is that we get this right with girls and young women growing up, you know, to really support them to be more confident and to take up more space. And I think that really matters, right? Because by the time women get to the boardroom, there's definitely an established connection then between their confidence levels and how competent people think they are.
That's right.
I mean, do you have any research on that?
I have a lot of data on that. My main area of research was around stereotypes of warmth and confidence. That's what my dissertation was on. So all of that work on warmth and confidence was work that my advisor was doing with me and some other collaborators. And, you know, all the work on stereotype backlash and, you know, stereotypes of women as warm and incompetent, or if they're competent, they're not seen as warm. So much of that came out of the lab that I was trained in. But we always were measuring, you know, in many different cultures, perceptions of both confidence and competence, and they're extremely highly correlated. You know, they're nearly perfectly correlated, the perceptions of those things, not the actual traits themselves, but the perception of those traits. So if someone's seen as confident, they are seen as competent, right? If you manipulate a person's expressed confidence, people will infer that they are more competent. So you are exactly right. And if women are showing less confidence, people attribute that lack of expressed confidence to a lack of actual competence, when really it's about what women think they're allowed to do. It's about conforming to the stereotype of your group. Now, I should say, I think that we are seeing dramatic leaps forward right now. That's just in the last couple of years, in the last maybe, you know, 3 or 4 years. I think we're really seeing changes. I think we see a lot of people, you know, men included, embracing those changes. Certainly, you know, anyone who has a daughter wants their daughter to feel that they can be as confident as their sons, right? They want their daughters to have every opportunity. We're clearly not there yet, but we're definitely seeing progress, and that makes me hopeful.
You know, Amy, it's so great that you've touched on what parents can do to maybe apply some of your research. I guess my next question, though, is what about workplaces? So what can organizations do to support women to speak up and display their confidence?
You know, I think, first of all, organizations from the top down have to commit to gender equality as a top priority. It has to be something that the leaders deeply sort of believe in and internalize and behave in a way that's consistent with, that it's not a one-off. You don't just go into one day of gender training and then, you know, you check off that box and you're done. I think one of the things that is working quite well, and I think this is especially important today because one of the responses to the Me Too movement is that, you know, we're hearing that men are saying, oh, now I'm afraid to mentor women. I don't want to mentor women because I'm afraid I'll do something wrong. Well, you know, assign mentees to men, right? That you assign them and help to manage those interactions, right? It's so important that people have mentors, and not all women can have female mentors, nor should they all have female mentors, and vice versa, right? I mean, not all men should have male mentors. You know, I think using objective versus subjective evaluations, you know, having clear benchmarks and measures, this is one of the things that really helps women. So if you see qualitative evaluations of women where the women are being described as somehow, you know, really smart, really competent, but we don't really like working with her. So if you see that competent but cold stereotype coming through in a qualitative evaluation, that is a red flag. Now, that doesn't mean that it's not true of that individual, but you're less likely to see it in evaluations of men. And when you see it in an evaluation of women, you should look more deeply to make sure that that is not a case where the woman's being held to a higher warmth standard, right? She's expected to be friendlier and warmer than the man. Another thing we can do is to address work-life balance for everyone, not just as a special policy for women, right? When we talk about work-life balance, people very quickly associate that with gender, and this is for the female employees of the organization, and it's not, it's for everyone. You know, work-life balance is for everyone.
So look, Amy, most people who come on She Innovates know this. We always like to get a piece of advice from whoever we're interviewing on what our listeners can do and how they can apply your research. So have you got sort of things that you think any of our listeners can apply day to day that might help support them with confidence in the workplace?
Well, I guess first, women who demonstrate, you know, warmth and confidence do avoid backlash, right? So this is true for everyone. It is the most important thing you can do to be admired and respected by your coworkers is to make sure that you are forming, you know, trusting relationships, right? So I say connect, then lead. Focus on warmth and connection before showing your strength and your competence. That doesn't mean that you should appear incompetent, but the problem is that people prioritize competence and strength over warmth when they're trying to figure out how to present themselves. And when we do that, before we've established that we're a trustworthy person, people find it hard to see the trustworthiness. That's true for people across the board. So just keep in mind that it's always the connection. And being warm and trustworthy is not the same as being soft and incompetent. We conflate those things, but they are not the same. You know, there's no evidence that people who are nice are less competent. And yeah, being nice is not the same as being a pushover. Remember that people are attracted to authenticity. When you are your authentic self, you are more compelling. So don't try to be somebody else. Try to be the strongest version of who you are. I would say make it clear to your superiors that, you know, you seek challenges to develop your skills and to contribute to the organization. So that way you avoid that paternalistic treatment. If it's very clear that, look, you want to grow as an employee and also, I mean, in whatever role you're in and be contributing to the organization, any half-decent manager is going to say, great, I'm going to give you some challenges. And that gives you an opportunity to kind of show your chops. Keep in mind, too, that it's not competence that people dislike. It's dominance. And dominance is just generally a quality that doesn't come across well. You know, some people can get away with it, and especially people who have already acquired power. But it's not the same. So just as warmth is not the same as being a pushover, competence is not the same as being dominant.
That's absolutely right. And I think that's actually one of the challenges with this. You know, how do you display confidence in a way that doesn't come across as dominant or arrogant? I mean, do you have any advice on that?
Oh, yeah. I always say, you know, confidence is not the same as arrogance. And confidence is a tool and arrogance is a weapon. Confidence sort of invites people in. And I think that arrogance pushes people away. So people use arrogance as a smokescreen for insecurity. So they use it as a wall to prevent people from challenging them. And the thing is, it does prevent people from challenging you, but not because they think you're smart. It's because they don't want to be around you. You know? So arrogance is not a compelling trait. Whether you're female or male, it's not a compelling trait. Yeah, and find support from savvy people, men and women who understand the cross pressures that women face. And you can almost always find allies. So, you know, make sure that you have a community for yourself. And that doesn't have to be made up only of women.
Isn't Amy fantastic? You know, I really hope you guys were all able to pick up some great advice from our conversation today. I loved Amy's idea that confidence is a tool and arrogance is a weapon, and that by taking up more space, we can literally come across as more confident at work, and that in turn can change people's perceptions of our competence. Amy also made a really great point about the importance of connecting with people first before trying to lead them. So I really hope you enjoyed this conversation, and you know, if you're liking our show, please do us a favor and subscribe to the She Innovates podcast on iTunes or Podbean or wherever you listen to podcasts. So thanks again for tuning in this week, and we'll catch you guys again next week.
She Innovates is produced by Human Group Media, a company that inspires people to do good through the power of audio storytelling. This podcast is made possible by SAP NextGen, an innovation platform that enables everyone, from individuals, companies, partners, and universities, to connect and innovate with purpose. In doing so, SAP NextGen supports the achievement of the Sustainable Development Goals.